I'm going to explain what went on at the conference, the format, the reason this conference was held, the theme, things like that. Then talk about the three specific sessions that Lisa and I both went to. She's going to be the reactor. Her eyes start to flash. You know, something's going on. Then kind of conclude with the remarks that the entire conference was drawn to close with. And then we can kind of talk about whether people are interested in pursuing study on hunger or related issues here at the village in the next month or so, however long people would like to pursue that. A hopeful thing that was explained at the conference, or I just never heard the fact before, was that Bread for the World is a Christian organization, political organization, which works for hungry people throughout the world, but within the framework of being American citizens. And the group began with 12 people on the east side of New York in 1973. And now there are 31,000 members of Bread for the World. And that's not too bad a track record for 7 years. The conference theme in Seattle was, how does a university community do justice towards the hungry? Now, the theme wasn't a real central focus of the entire conference. The opening remarks the first evening, we arrived on a Friday, registered, there was about an hour and a half of opening remarks by Tony Cernera, who's the chairperson of the Bread for the World Education Fund in New York City. And then some opening remarks by the acting president of Whitworth College in Spokane, which is a very active campus on the hunger issue. They have an alternative eating program on campus, nutritionally and justice-oriented, severe cutback in sugar in the diet.
What's his name, you remember?
Yes, Duncan Ferguson.
Whitworth?
Right. And I have a brochure on what they're doing at their college campus. A similar thing was tried at PLU last year, but the campus politics kind of shot a lot of holes in that, and it's fizzled, much to the dismay of many students and people on that campus. So they kind of opened the conference up, but most of the sessions dealt with things unrelated or not directly related to a university community's response. They were things that anyone who walked in would feel like it was a relevant thing for non-students to listen to, just as much as students. There were about 21 sessions offered, something like that, which was very frustrating because you could only go to 3 of them. You had to choose between about 8 options for each of the 3-hour sessions. And they were led by sociologists, political scientists, theologians. Many of the people leading sessions were faculty at Seattle University, which is a Jesuit-affiliated Catholic private college. And I'd say in general that the faculty was just impressive in how well-versed they are on the hunger issue and all the related issues, because once you start talking about hunger, you're going to start talking about global militarism, arms spending, economic systems. So kind of whatever you were interested in, you could find something, a session that was probably going to be offered on that. The sessions that we went to, the first one was the politics of food scarcity. And basically it was an economic and political critique of the capitalist market system. And the two people who led it, one was a nun and one was a priest, and they had taught a course with this title. And they said they ended up with a bunch of students who felt like the whole problem of world hunger was so huge that there was no hope. And they weren't going to really try to do anything. They were just going to live their private lives and forget about it. But a few people in that class became very motivated about the hunger issue and the American complicity in the whole global problem. And so there was a real mix in views, whether people thought you know, if there was any hope in working on the thing or not.
The people in the classes, the, none of the priests thought that was their reaction.
People in the session, well, I just kept being amazed about how informed people who attended the conference were. Not just the instructors, but there were students, there were retired people, there were business people, people from all across the economic and social strata, it seemed. But they were very well informed, and a lot of people doing things like war tax resisting, not paying a portion of their income tax, not paying their telephone tax. When you start talking to people, see what they're doing in response to what they see as part of the root causes of food shortages in the world and the problem with our economic system and the way we spend our federal budget. It was exciting to hear. Sometimes it seems like it's only up here told that people care about it, and that's just not at all true.
Why wouldn't people pay the telephone taxes?
Telephone tax goes into military. It's a military tax, yeah. Mm-hmm. On your monthly telephone bill, the tax that's on there is a military tax.
What's the rationale for that?
It goes into the defense budget. Just a good way to get rid of it.
Being reduced now.
It's supposed to be eliminated.
It was three, and now it's going down to two. I mean, 3 years is going to be eliminated entirely.
Hope so. I don't know.
I know it's on its way out.
That's good.
Oh, good try. Supposedly it might come next month anyways.
Yeah. It's one tax that you cannot pay that the telephone company doesn't mind if you don't pay it. Because it's no skin off their nose. And it's usually such a minimal amount of money that the government won't spend the time and energy to come collect it from you. But sometimes the telephone company will simply add it onto your next bill. So you have to, if you're going to resist in that way, you have to really watch your bill and see if they just aren't adding your tax resistance into the next month's balance. So that's kind of interesting. One woman, apparently that had happened to her. So she warned us about that. I think the thing that struck me most about that first session was that both the sociologist, the father and the sister, in their professional roles as political philosopher and an economist, they both felt that the general trend throughout the world was going to be towards authoritarian governments, including the United States, because in the next 20 to 30 years, the hunger problems and the energy crunches are going to become increasingly severe to the point where people will have to be forced to change how they use their resources. And it came up time and again that people probably will not voluntarily give up driving their cars or this or that. And so they saw a global trend towards authoritarian governments. And that kind of jives with what a lot of economists were saying here last summer that were on faculty in the village. That was amazing to me. But in countries where there aren't violent revolutions to overthrow orders that keep people in a poverty situation, even where governments are in a state of evolution rather than revolution, the trend will be towards more control and less choice to live differently or use resources differently, simply because the situation will get so tight that it will be forced upon people. And so, of course, they were advocating that we could respond and change now to the situation, especially out of our call to be concerned radically for those who don't have enough to eat. One out of eight people in the world is malnourished. And these facts just kind of kept building up on your back as the day went by. People laughed, though. I mean, it wasn't like it was a big morbid thing. But we managed to not get depressed about it. People still had hope at the end of all these sessions. Do you want to react to anything about that first session? Or does anybody have any kind of questions?
Was that just the main, their main thing that, I mean, what political, I mean, I don't know what I want to ask, but I'm just interested in, maybe go on and finish and then maybe we can go back. And,
okay. Well, they did critique the capitalist market system as being based upon a profit, self-centered motive, and also upon a theory of unlimited resources. So they didn't really advocate socialism, but they said, given the world economic structures and the crunch for resources that we are just beginning to see the tip of the iceberg of that crunch, that socialism at least operates within realities much more than a profit market economy. They didn't have a blueprint. None of the sessions offered a blueprint for how to solve the whole thing. They were all saying things like, the whole issue is so connected to this issue or this issue that you felt like there were strings all over the place and you kept seeing connections or hearing these experts in their different fields pointing towards another area that was crucial, that you know, there were no easy answers offered. They were trying to underscore the fact that it is a complex issue and that it's going to encompass the whole way we live and the whole way we think about how people live. It's not just, well, if we give enough foreign aid to underdeveloped countries, everything would be solved. They just shot holes in a lot of simplistic ideas about how to solve world hunger problems. Then we went to another session, and this one fed right in, or followed nicely from the first one we went to, and that was on multinationals. The Menace is what the title of the course was. And a sociologist and a political scientist, also on the faculty at SU, these were non-ordained people, led this session. And they kind of redefined multinational corporation for us. They called it transnational conglomeration, which they're trying to explain that a multinational isn't a company that works in cooperation with many nations, but that it's a company that operates across national boundaries with a lot of freedom. That's usually based in one country. And most of the multinationals in the world are either based in West Germany, Japan, or the United States. And both the German and the Japanese economic systems are our transplants from the Marshall Plan, the reconstruction of their economic systems after World War II. So they're all very American in that respect. The sociologist was quite pessimistic about multinationals. He said that in the world economic scene, there are three major factors. One being consumers. Everyone who must buy, eat, you know, so that's all of us. The multinationals as a very primary and important entity, and then nation states. And he kind of billed the multinationals as being the Leviathan, or the monster of the global economic system. That sector of the economy over which people have the least control and over which governments seem to be having less and less control. That oftentimes one nation will legislate to try and limit the power of a multinational, and they will simply shift headquarters or a plant to another country which has more favorable investment climate, and so they really painted a black picture. People were just kind of shifting in their chairs and looking very uncomfortable. And the conclusion the sociologists came to was that of the three entities, perhaps, you know, we can work to advocate change using our citizenship, writing senators and, you know, being active as citizens of a nation state. We can really be active as a consumer. And he advocated thinking small and thinking regionally. Be active politically, but start where you are. on your community level. And he really saw a lot of hope for the Pacific Northwest as a region to begin to work and live within its resources, to not be dependent upon, you know, produce shipped up from California, or just a lot of simple things that you make those choices constantly as a consumer.
That, you know, that's really neat, but look at the resources. Timber, water power. It's a prime area.
Uh-huh.
We're fortunate. Yeah, we're fortunate. In a way, we ought to look at living in less than our own resources so that we can share some of those resources that are just rich.
I agree. He didn't touch on that one at all. From what he was saying, I had that sense that that would be what he would, you know, if he had time to say a lot more, and he really wanted to go on.
Well, you said one of them was optimistic about the multinationals. In what way?
I don't think I said that.
Well,
he was optimistic about the situation and seeing that you could do something about it as a consumer and as a citizen.
Well, I don't know whether this is off the subject, but the word multinational means a lot to me because I spent an entire economics class just talking about multinational corporations in my fourth year in college. But to me, I guess the thing I'm saying is if I had not had that, what you just said, multinational, would just be a big word that wouldn't mean much. But maybe everyone else here is really informed, so they kind of know what multinational means.
Would be a good definition. Well, do you have a good definition?
Well, I think, I'm not a very good definer, but I think what Marilyn said about them being located in West Germany, Japan, and the United States, they're companies that began usually in one country, and then they broadened their operations to several countries. Well, like the oil companies are multinational corporations. And for example, because they're spread out, they have, well, like Exxon, which is the biggest corporation in the world, has oil fields all over the world, and then outlets and parts of the company.
Yeah, he explained that they were either, many of them were either horizontal or vertical. Meaning vertical, they own the oil company, the refinery, the every part of the process up to the gas station, and that was the vertical. And then horizontal would be a company like Exxon that would own, maybe EMT, this large company that he...
Oh, he's talking about IT&T, that owned the bakery down the street.
Well, no, so they would have money. Totally unrelated. So they had their nose in everywhere.
I can recall from last summer talking about multinationals is the fact that, I mean, some of the effects, if you go into some of the effects of where they really hurt the low-income people in the world, apparently they make a practice of going into a country using the resources and the labor and making a profit, which in the end gets shipped out and gets taken back to the country. Multinational that has as a home base, so all the profit isn't reinvested into the company, into the local area. Mm-hmm. It's not put back into the economy, it's just removed, which really, really hurts.
Yeah, they brought up that point quite a bit about saying that, well, large companies going into underdeveloped countries, that's really, a lot of people think that's just great because they're bringing business in. Well, that's not very true because it doesn't go back to the, rarely goes back to the local people.
Or even
you mean that doesn't go back to the local people?
One example that hits me is Singapore is now a very large manufacturer of cameras. A lot of Japanese and German camera companies have plants in Singapore where in cheap labor puts together the cameras, but then they get paid their money, but the camera really does absolutely nothing for the country in a sense because they're shipped back and sold in like the United States or in Europe or Japan, and so there's really none of the profit from the work really ends up in Singapore, except for the actual labor, but that doesn't really help the country that much as well.
And the factories tend to shift to a country that where there are worse wages. for the workers. You know, as soon as a union is formed in a country, a strong union movement, labor movement, and where salaries or wages are begun on the rise up to subsistence or above subsistence level, oftentimes multinationals, you can practically dot them, you know, around the world on maps, as they move out, as soon as wages start going up, because you know, they can't make as good a profit. And they've cited a few statistics on, yeah, Dolkin have moved out of Hawaii and went to the Philippines, or
it's cheaper labor. And then the people who have changed their lifestyle almost to work in the plants, you know, are left with nothing.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's what always bothers me about some of these statistics. I'm not sure that Dolkin might have moved out of Hawaii because of changing labor situation. The EPA, at least from what I've read, and I'm not sure specifically about Dole, but the reason that the pineapple and the sugar industry in Hawaii has gone down the drain is the EPA regulations on air pollution. Uh-huh. At least with the cane, they're not allowed to burn the cane any longer, which is an integral part of the process, and so that they had no choice but to leave. You know, I would think that even though multinationals have some very bad reputation, and you know, they deserve, I think, the press in a lot of ways, I would hope that there might be one example of one multinational that isn't all negative. I always get worried when, you know, when everything's negative about something. And I guess the other thing that bothers me is it almost gets down to discussion of like free enterprise, the capitalistic system, and Christianity. Christianity and capitalism, in a way, aren't really compatible. And yet, you know, we still, I think, they're a part of the capitalistic system. There have been some, I think, some great things that have happened as a result of it, not certainly all of them. But, you know, you almost have to decide whether you're going to agree to a capitalistic free enterprise system and start, you know, discussion on that basis, in a sense. And then say, well, you know, multinationals are maybe a poor example, but still an example of, you know, that system where you try to maximize profit, you know, for your investors. And if you're an investor in a corporation, that's, you know, why you're an investor, because you want to get some profits. It's that simple. And anybody who's taking money out of a savings account and put it into a higher, you know, savings, you know, certificate or anything else is somebody who would like a little bit more profit out of it. And the only reason that they're doing that is because they're investing it in corporations who are maximizing profits. And the way they're maximizing profits is going into countries that are in some ways taking advantage. So I don't know, I think there should be a better way to, you know, approach the problem rather than just, you know, like run down the multinationals.
I agree that it's like a systemic problem. It's of the system. Fact that there is a monolithic profit motive, you know. I mean, this is the motive that makes things run, you know, makes the whole capitalistic system go. And as a result, it overshadows every other concern. I mean,
what motive do you think should be at the head of a business?
Well, you can't really talk in those terms, because if you have a business, you're talking profit motive.
Is there such a thing as excessive profit and profit that in greed, and isn't a business part of the motivation of a business should be the good of the community?
We put robbers and criminals in prison, and they have a tremendous profit motive. Evidently, somebody's decided there's a point at which is no longer acceptable.
Yeah, embezzling, you know, is
embezzling is good profit motive.
Well, multinationals do benefit some people, and mm-hmm. in the third world countries in which they tend to be, you know, drawing natural resources and building factories, it's usually like a top 10% of the population that gets some very real benefits from their existence there. You can take, you know, there are just multiple examples in Africa of where raw materials are being taken out of the country, and a power elite at the top, people who have money, are sustaining their oftentimes westernized way of life, and it doesn't ever filter down to affect the standard of living of the majority of the population.
Is that partly the problem of the political systems of those countries?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I think in the United States there was a situation here where the capitalistic system, in a sense, was involved in an ideal, you know, growing grounds. Because I think that it's still true that there were and are a small percentage of the top that really reap the benefits. But all of us, in a sense, reap benefits unless, you know, right down the line.
In this country, that's true.
Yeah.
Do we have
yeah,
a right
so
to
that move it's, and that's really, you know, again, it may not be the corporation problem. Like Karen said, it may be a political system that's eliminated, you know, that good to be felt by the entire, you know, country.
And I question all of us. I think you find a third world in this country, too, that's being,
well, yeah,
that
but
is
still,
being ripped off by the
yeah,
system.
Yeah, well, that's true. And there, I mean, there's a full gamut of the economic system. But I think that in one way, and maybe a very minor way, everybody still benefits. You know, even the very poorest in this country is still benefiting from.
Maybe what we're saying is that they're not benefiting enough.
Well, that's true.
I think, I was just going to say, the argument that you're saying there is the same, very same argument that the multinational will take to a third world country and say, this is what's going to happen and it'll never happen.
Well,
I mean, we'll say,
you know,
really
it
about.
May be that not. Well, I'm not trying to defend the multinational, but, you know, it may be that the motive of an executive might be that. But if, I mean, he can see where the statement that he makes is true, given the right political system, which would allow the benefits, you know, to be felt by a larger, you know, percentage of the country. Now, if the political system is such that doesn't happen, well then, you know, is it the multinational that's at fault? Is it the political system, or, you know, what do you do? Is it better to have everybody poor? I don't know. You know, I'm really, I guess, confused at this point. And, you know, like in trying to work with a country.
I think we as a consumer are as much at fault as a multinational when they move into another country to use their resources and then we gain from that and they bring whatever it is home for us to use.
Do you know anything about, could you give a few details on the land issue? Did you talk about that?
Yes, it is, and I'll just say a little bit about that. The Bread for the World's emphasis, since you bring it up now.
I thought it fit in as far as changing the structure.
It does.
Is that the third session you went to?
No.
Or included?
It's related into what we're saying about structural changes in the political system. Bread for the World's emphasis in the following year is going to be on land reform. And I get an African newspaper, and I was just reading about the land reform that they're attempting now in Zimbabwe. And what has been their traditional, or their legal, land policy under the white Rhodesian government. There were areas of the country set up which were tribally owned. There were areas which were owned by Europeans, there were parks set aside, and then there were kind of regions up for grabs, for either blacks or whites. And what happened under that political system was that literally all of the best farming land was given a European zoning. And so now they are beginning to struggle in that country with breaking down what the past system put into effect without destroying their economic system as it's operating now. It's a capitalistic system right now, and Robert Mugabe is struggling to not totally destroy that system by his land reform program, because, like you said, Werner, there comes a point where, you know, everybody is going to be hurt if there's chaos. And so it will be fascinating to see how Zimbabwe handles that, how they walk that tightrope between changing a system to where its values are motivated, or its values are based on human needs and meeting those human needs regardless of color, and not destroying your entire economic system and therefore your ability to begin to help those who don't have even subsistence lifestyles at the present time. Very complex, and what the sociologist kind of ended with saying was that basically it is a value question, that we can't deny that, that all economic and political systems operate on some baseline values, and we have to dare to look at those values and see what they really are based upon. And as Christians, if we feel that there's a definite conflict between what we see as the gospel or kingdom value and the underlying value of an economic system, we have to work towards living out or living upon more just values. And it's, like you said, it's not simple at all. But that would be a whole realm of study, I think, if we decided to get a hunger group together, would be to try and understand the role of multinationals in the entire global economic system, because it's growing more and more interdependent now rather than independent. And I'm not very well economically versed. I need to understand a lot more about how those structures operate before I can, in a rational, hopeful way, begin to work for some kinds of changes. The last session we went to then was on food powerlessness and military power. And this was led by a man who works for the Oregon Commission on Peace. And he was trying to show the strings or the ties between military intervention and action throughout the world, foreign policy, and the whole hunger issue. His basic premise was that the United States, since World War II, has had an interventionist foreign policy. And he gave some astounding statistics that can't be argued. They're hard and fast facts. There have been 115 violent conflicts in the world since 1952 alone. 91 of those have been internal conflicts. In other words, 80% of the violent activity on the globe has been of revolutionary type, civil, internal strife leading to internal warfare. Since 1948, the United States has intervened in, how many do I have here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. At least 15 of these kinds of conflicts, and Henry Kissinger has called them invisible wars. And this was a basic part of what's called the Nixon Doctrine. It's been part of our confessed foreign policy. Greece in 1948, these were all CIA involvements. Sometimes overt military invasion, but usually CIA.
Okay, 15 of the 91 internal conflicts. And by internal conflicts, you mean like a conflict within a specific nation state, within a specific
country. Like Nicaragua and the Sandinista Revolution in Chile.
In what way would the CIA be involved?
Okay. Usually, Well, how he explained it, or this was his theory that he's working upon, is that the United States, in our foreign policy, our chief concern is to maintain a good investment climate in a foreign country. And that's our chief goal in our relations to a country, is an economic relation, a good place for American investment. And what our foreign policy has done is to try and maintain a good climate investment, stability, a government in power which favors a capitalistic profit system, which will allow multinationals and private American investors on a smaller scale to come in and invest and build factories, whatever, in their country. So the United States has tended to favor different types of political regimes in a definite order. First of all, we would like for other countries to have genuine democracies in which the people would have a voice in their own government, and that would be a good investment climate for American company, kind of leaning towards a capitalist economy. But democracy is our first choice in what we would like to see another country have, and what we think would favor a good economic climate. The second choice is an authoritarian ruler, someone like the Shah of Iran, who maintains stability in a country so that business can go on as usual. And we're willing to accept a degree of oppression if it will still give American business interests a certain degree of freedom to operate in that system. And the last option, political option, which our foreign policy has tended to strongly oppose, was any kind of regime that leaned towards socialism or the left, Marxism, communism. You put all sorts of degrees onto that. So the policy in the interventions was that whenever a critical investment area in the world began to destabilize, oftentimes because there was some kind of a Marxist or people's movement within the population for a change in the existing economic structure, the CIA, in cooperation sometimes with multinationals, like in Guatemala, the CIA actually infiltrated the company on United Fruit shipping lines, is how they got into the country to be involved in that. Covert operations, you know.
CIA agents would work for United Fruit, is that what you're saying?
No, they would contact people in United Fruit, and that's how they would sneak into countries to be involved in the overthrow of either a new leftist-leaning leader to get him out of power and put a former pro-West person back into power. Mm-hmm. I need a whole lot more study in this entire area, but I'll just read the list, and maybe some of you either remember the events better or studied them at some point. But the CIA, this is documented involvement, was involved in Greece in 1948, Iran in putting the Shah back in power in 1953, Guatemala in 1954, a left-leaning president who was beginning land reforms, raising wages, was ousted out of power. Indonesia in 1958, Lebanon 1958, Laos 1960, Cuba 1961, our failure was the Bay of Pigs. The Congo in 1964, British Guiana 1964, the Dominican Republic in 1965, then the more recent ones, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Chile. What the fellow from the Peace Commission said was that the United States in our foreign policy is ignoring a global fact, and that is the fact of a revolutionary temperament throughout the globe. That people are beginning to look at the systems that are keeping them below a subsistence level. And there are, well, a lot of leftist groups in countries, especially developing countries throughout the world. And you can think of all the little abbreviations. I mean, SWAPO in Namibia, Nicaraguan, what are they, Sandinistas? I mean, if you just kind of flash reading the newspaper through your mind in the past years, you hear mention of a lot of people's groups, violent revolutionary groups who are advocating changes within their country. Well, the CIA and the United States hasn't taken seriously the reasons for these violent outbreaks throughout the world. That we have tended to operate on a conservative outlook. We are trying to maintain stability in a world which is rife with instability, that conditions are getting to the point where people will not take stability at any cost. He also made the argument that war is simply obsolete, that we are still developing military strategies based upon limited wars, trying to maintain the U.S. influence and presence in places. We haven't taken into consideration the guerrilla-type warfare, which is almost impossible to rout out using conventional military methods. The Soviet Union is running up against the same problem in Afghanistan. We have an entire population which is very poorly organized militarily, but people are simply rebelling in their little villages and communities. There is very little centralized organization in that revolution, but it's just the whole population is, not the whole, of course there are some who are cooperating, but that seems to be the general mood and activity in that entire nation is to revolt against an external power pressing their agenda upon another people. So the thrust of his argument was that our foreign policy is just totally backwards and trying to operate outside of the realities.
What do you know about this man? Saying all this.
Well, he's a teacher, and my impression was that he taught high school and college level, perhaps. Clean-cut business suit.
Yeah, the thought keeps occurring to me I'm not sure what the alternatives are. I mean, it sounds like we so often, you know, in retrospect, sure, we can say that the Shah was, you know, killed a lot of people. The proof is there.
150,000.
Yeah, what about Khomeini? And where do you go? I mean, you support an overthrow of one bad ruler, and you end up with somebody who kills another 150,000.
Well, the question of the Shah is, what was Mossadegh like? That was who was overthrown and put the Shah in. I mean, Khomeini, we're not supporting Khomeini.
No, but I know, but I mean, in so many of the overthrows that have taken place, that what do you? I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, we should have kept the Shah in, but. You know, I mean, who do you support nowadays that isn't going to justify murder on the basis of, you know, it's just an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth?
He brought up Khomeini, and he, I can't remember, he threw out a statistic of the number of people who have been killed since Khomeini came into power, and it wasn't even a fraction of what was perpetuated under the Shah.
It's just been 1 year. He's just getting revved up.
Well, also, the secret police under the Shah has been likened by Amnesty International to being worse than the Gestapo.
I'm not saying that.
But you're saying, what's the viable option?
Yeah, I mean, does Khomeini, is he justified in killing because the Shah was bad? You know?
Well, I think we have to oppose all killing. But do we give our economic support, and does our president go and make speeches about a man saying he has the support and love of his entire population, you know, months before he's thrown out of power? Right. I mean, that was a total operation outside of reality.
By the will of the majority of the people in that country, it was self-determination, no matter how our values. While the Shah was, you know, was held in power by outside, as I understand it now.
But it is a, you know, it's just a, I think, a discouraging situation, to say the least.
I've never heard, you know, I've never heard a statement made like you said about American foreign policy, that their prime goal is to maintain, is to see foreign governments have stable governments for a favorable economic climate. I mean, I guess I can't, dispute that. I don't know.
Well, I think it's very possible, probably.
Paul Lee talked about this when he was here for example, in Chile under Allende, CIA sabotaged trucks and did everything they could to...
I'm talking out of ignorance, but I would at least think that there's another option for getting to the same point without that being the prime motive. In other words,
another option for who to get to what point?
Well, the same thing where the United States has a foreign policy that favors stability in countries, but without the economic factor becoming the prime motive for the whole foreign policy. In other words, I mean, as I say, I'm speaking of ignorance, but just logic says that over a period of years, the United States, through businesses that belonged to the United States, became involved in countries. Many of them were invited in by foreign countries. Many of them may have gone there without being invited in. I don't know. But once such a huge investment, became a reality in some of these countries, then an unstable government got into power, which threatened, American investment. Well, then the United States, maybe because of commitments to allies, then would step in. I think there's another option without, again, definitely saying that the United States, has a foreign policy that's totally dictated by, out of selfish economic means. I'm not sure that I'm ready to go that far.
I understand that. I can see that there are probably other motives, that all tie together before a decision is made. Yeah. It seems that Jimmy Carter's human rights thing is a very personal thing that a lot of Americans can side along with, and they like that. And it's another motive that could be suggested for any action taken by the United States. But when I see that as another side of that issue, it seems that an economic argument would be the foremost thing if you put the two alongside. Like if you said that this particular government is stable but it's oppressing people, you would still go with it. The United States foreign policy would still go with it if there's a marginal amount.
Our motives may be wrong in both cases, but I think that it might be the easy way out to say that the foreign policy of the United States is purely dictated, out of economic.
He gave a lot of quotes from Kissinger that he was reading out of articles and things that I couldn't write fast enough to get down. So one thing I liked about what he was saying was that he wasn't just paraphrasing or condensing things that he had gleaned over the years, but he was quoting the people who were making foreign policy decisions and acting upon them, and calling our foreign policy an interventionist, invisible war policy. That came straight out of the mouth of Henry Kissinger. And, I guess I was kind of shocked that even if those were the motives, that he'd be so blatant about it.
I've read this directly from Kissinger, and you're almost shocked, that it's that, that it was that blatant. I don't know if that's Carter's...
Well, he's at least living with the aftermath
of
what's been set in motion.
One other, an earlier discussion this winter, I don't remember what, I guess it was something to do with war again, but even the economic things that we're talking about, I think get down to, a very personal thing. And, you know, you almost have to start at that point and say, you know, am I willing to, you know, have my goods taken over by someone without defending? I mean, how many of us would allow somebody to walk into our room and just start taking things?
Why don't we give it up willingly before they
do? That's right. I mean, that's the option, and that's really what we're saying. That's where we really get down to Christian, you know, principles. But what I'm trying to say is that let's self-examine ourselves and say, if I'm not willing to do that, well, then can I criticize a country or my country for defending its personal possessions? You know, I mean, and, you know, I think, I guess for me, I've got to sort of set my own house straight first and say, am I willing to hand over to others my possessions? If I'm not, well, then it helps me to understand what my country is not willing, because my country is made up of 200 million people like myself. Mm-hmm. And then, to me, it's on a different perspective again.
Well, I think they have to occur simultaneously, because we'll never get our individual acts together and say, okay, now my life is consistent and I can critique my social
group. Simultaneously, but not criticizing, or not let's say, forgetting to look at our own lives, you know, while we're only criticizing, you know, the community, whether it be, you know, the whole community or the national community or international community.
The whole tone of the conference was on the social instead of the private. I forgot to mention that, but in the opening remarks they said the entire trend of our culture is to be internalizing, and of Christianity, that is often our tendency, that it's an internal affair, it's a relationship between you and God. So they said in this conference our sessions are going to try and turn you outside of yourself and look at systematic social things that are realities in the world hunger issue. That's very important, and I didn't get that in there, because that came up, it was mentioned by people in sessions, that we were trying to take a social perspective on this. And, you know, as difficult and messy as that gets to be, and just from what people were saying, it sounded like people were personally struggling to be privately consistent with what they were advocating as social policies. And that's, you know, that's a huge question, and one that I think we've got to address. We're going to say, you know, I care about world hunger. If we never do anything about it in the way we live or what we're willing to give up, then tinkling brass and sounding cymbals. We did end that one particular session by talking about things we could do as individual people. And because a lot of people in the group felt that military expenditures, which I've got that written down someplace, the 1981 budget, 24% of our budget is going for defense spending, and that's a conservative estimate. There are a lot of peace organizations which would say 40% of our budget actually ends up directly supporting military systems and giving military aid. 24%, which is very conservative. That's $147.9 billion. That's for the 1981 budget. If you get Bread for the World letters or anything like that, in Congress in the past month and a half, budgets are in committee and they're trying to decide on making cuts and trying to balance the budget as they usually are trying to do. And they have been making drastic cuts in foreign aid, or talking about it, in foreign aid to non-military foreign aid. That is, in the United States food stamp program is threatened to be extinct by October 1. Or no funding, at least until the next budget is set for the following year. There wouldn't be any money allocated from October to June, I believe, because they're simply running out of funds and there's a budget ceiling on that. Anyway, the conservative climate in Congress is to cut back on federal expenditures. And what's also true at the same time that they're searching to make cuts, they're making cuts in aid to foreign countries, less developed countries, and they're proposing no cuts in the military budget. I figured out, let's see, I'll read this thing. Last year, the United States spent $115 billion for military defense and only $7.2 billion for economic aid to poorer nations of the world. In fact, in the past 30 years, the U.S. has spent over 50 times more money on military operations in less developed countries than on development aid. Robert McNamara, former Secretary of Defense and presently head of the World Bank, 20% of which is controlled by the United States, or funds comes from the United States, responds, "Unless there is a different allocation of resources in the industrialized nations from military development to human development in the poorer nations, we shall not have a peaceful world. We cannot build a secure world on a foundation of human misery." When you start reading those types of statistics, you very soon become overwhelmed and depressed. The United States ranks 12th in the percentage of its gross national product, which it gives in economic aid of a non-military variety to less developed countries. Right now, it's 0.22% of our gross national product, which goes towards less developed countries.
That's been declining, hasn't it? I mean,
yes, it was 2.7 under the Marshall Plan.
We used to be higher up there.
Yeah, it's consistently gone downhill. In total gross aid, you know, in dollars, compare how much we give compared to another country. We are the biggest donor, and I think that's important, because it can make it sound like we give just a piddly amount. I mean, it still is more than any other single country gives in aid. But, the last thing I was going to talk about,
they were suggesting that we could do, that you started and then we got off?
War tax resistance, refusing to pay 24% of your income tax, which goes to support defense systems. It's a private decision whether you see all military and defense expenditures as being appropriate, as you know, and in agreement with your Christian conviction.
How can they not pay part of your income?
Well, I'm studying that out right now. First of all, you have to ask your employer not to withhold any income tax. You can work that out with your employer. What you do is you subtract the percentage that would go towards military expenditures from the check that you send in. And what happens is the federal government, the IRS, will confiscate the money from your checking account, your savings account, or from your employer. The point is, they'll get the money, but the point is that you don't voluntarily pay it. And that's a whole nother issue that we could discuss in a world hunger group. I think that's very viable, and this is becoming talked more and more about in congregations. And not paying your telephone tax. Becoming aware of how the federal government is spending money currently, and if you're opposed to those expenditures, to write your senators and representatives and committee chair people, and really use your responsibility and your power as a citizen, even if it looks hopeless. That's another thing you brought up at the end of the conference, is that in spite of whether it looks like it's working, don't we have a responsibility to be advocates for those who don't even have a voice in their own government? Since the United States does have such a central position of power in the world economic situation, World Bank loans, all sorts of things. I mean, you could spend 24 hours a day writing letters. And that's another thing that I'd like a hunger group to be interested in, is how do we develop our personal responses to the issue? First, you have to know what it's about, and then you have to try and figure out what can you try to do, you know, to affect changes.
I think, you know, like on what you're saying about voluntary not paying taxes, seems to me the serious decision is that if we're going to be in a democracy, where part of the democracy is really a voluntary system, and that's all taxes are, they do have some power to collect taxes, but basically, federal income tax is a voluntary system. Mm-hmm. And if we collectively, through the motive of world hunger or any other motive, you know, say that voluntarily we're not going to pay 24%. Mm-hmm. In a sense, you know, I mean, there's a couple ways that it could go. It could do some good. or it could force the government to take away that voluntary freedom and, you know, get a notch further away from the democracy.
Which takes us back to where Marilyn started, with the opinion of the priest and the nun. We're going to have to lean more and more toward their authoritarian governments.
Well, that's right. But see, I mean, this is, I think, the sad part about it. Because
you have to look at the alternative.
Yeah, I mean, the benevolent dictatorship is, of course, most efficient. But, you know, it's never, you know, there's very few that have ever succeeded. You know, democracy, you know, is a very rare thing in the world, and it's...
It's not perfect, but what is better?
Well, that's it.
That you see, you have
well,
to
it's good for a portion of the population, but there are an awful
well,
lot of people
course,
who don't benefit from
democracy. It doesn't go on a consensus. It goes on majority. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things that what we're talking about, I think, would be against even the majority vote in this country, which, you know, like we've said before, that the Christian is a remnant. Mm-hmm. And we have to recognize this. But I think we also have to be careful. You know, I mean, we criticize the CIA for overthrow of certain government. You know, do we then justify, because of our motives, you know, the overthrow of a government, whether it be our own or someone else? I mean, it gets down to the situation ethics where, you know, where I guess it, you know, it does become an individual thing. For Bonhoeffer, you know, the mm-hmm. murder of Hitler was justified. Mm-hmm. But murder can't be justified, you know, with the eyes of God.
One thing that came to my mind at the conference, when it seemed that, you know, like war tax resistance and things like that might push the government towards allowing us less freedom, it reminded me of the trial of Jesus, especially out of the Gospel of John, where when people stand free in spite of all that tries to make them act as they're supposed to in compliance, that you begin to see the true nature of the powers. And there's an unmasking there of what really matters, or the values that really underlie a system that maybe appears benevolent or beneficial. And I'm not saying that there are no beneficial aspects to our system. I mean, I think that would be ludicrous to make that statement. I think the trend has been in this country is to baptize our system and say, you know, this is it. This is the best we've got. When in fact, it's the best for those who live within this country, and that's even highly debatable. But I guess to just begin to dare to look at our system very critically and see that, you know, you can't divorce American freedoms from third world oppressions. That a lot of what makes it possible for us to live free of hunger and inadequate clothing keeps people where that is the only thing they can think about. And
yes, sir. I was kind of confused. Is there a way to separate the two issues?
Of which?
Like if we wanted to live in a democracy and also didn't have to consume everything that we consume, and also wish that for another country. I'm just kind of thinking about here. I mean, we've all been raised to think democracy is a good system and the best system. Can democracy run, work apart from the whole consumption?
Does it have to, do capitalism and democracy go together?
Yes. Didn't you read the article in Time this week, and capitalism survived?
I saw the cover, but I didn't read the magazine.
I read it, but I have to read it again more carefully, I guess. I mean, it's kind of dead. It's not real radical. It's not. It's very. But can there be democracy without capitalism?
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because I think, like, possibly Yanga was going to try that, or possibly in, was it Czechoslovakia?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's been endeavors to experiment, but they have been crushed.
Mm-hmm. Kind of attempts at synthesis between democratic types of government and socialistic economic.
Yeah.
Of course, we are not a pure democracy. We have many socialistic traits in our system, too. The last thing, I'll try and wind this up, that was discussed, and I'll be brief about this, was the Presidential Commission report on world hunger, which Carter asked a committee to consider the world hunger problem in September of 1978 and asked that the final report be published by June 1, 1980. This is the preliminary report, which was published in December, and the final report is coming off the presses in D.C. right now. And I was reading through some of their preliminary recommendations. And their number one recommendation, and this is a committee of 20 people selected by the president, and Saul Aronowitz was his chairperson, and congressional people, some lay people, a couple people affiliated with Bread for the World were asked to be on this committee.
Who's Saul?
Have you heard the name? No?
I think so, I'm not sure.
Well, he's an administrative cabinet. Well, he doesn't have a cabinet position right now.
He's an administrative assistant.
I mean, an advisor to the president.
Oh.
Very thing. The first thing they recommended was a basic change in the American foreign policy. This is a critique from within our own government. They said in this report that our foreign policy tended to be based upon military and defense priorities and economic priorities rather than the good of the indigenous population, and that it was time in the decade of the 1980s for the number one priority in U.S. foreign relations to be, how does it say, our relationship with third world countries should be based.
While you're looking for that,
yeah.
As you're saying that, I think one of the most depressing things that I've become aware of in just reading the news and listening to news media this whole spring has been how, I mean, if Carter espouses a statement like that, he's dead politically. He can't be elected. I guess, from what they say, from what I understand.
What they say.
And I mean, I just find it extremely frustrating that our political election process is just, well, I guess the election process has to affect what a leader does, because if he wants to be elected by the majority, he's got to do what the majority wants. We're back at the authoritarian form of government. How do you get people to vote for what is right or good or what is good? I mean, it's very, very frustrating. But it seems like the whole Iranian thing with the hostages was timed for one of the primaries. Some, I don't know if you remember what it was, some statement that Carter was going to make was timed to happen just before the Wisconsin primary or something. And it just seems appalling. I don't know. That's what I thought of when you said that. We have to change our foreign policy.
Well, Andrew Young said about Iran that if he had been president, he would have apologized, but then he wouldn't have been president. Wouldn't be president if he would do something like that. I mean, well, here's the statement. The commission recommends that the United States make the elimination of hunger the primary focus of its relationship with the developing countries, beginning with the decade of the 1980s. And their conclusion in the report that is not our primary focus now. They advocated that the International Development Cooperative Agency Director, in other words, that's a fancy title for a specialist in development, global development, that be made a cabinet position. It is not a cabinet position currently, but this person be one of the president's primary advisors by being made into cabinet position. That our gross national product, non-military aid to developing countries be increased from 0.22% to 0.7% in a few years. They tend to be quite conservative, or at least that's the critique the Bread for the World people who formed a panel on the last night kind of said what they thought about this report. They said, you know, it's a beginning, but it's just that much. And the last recommendation was to increase U.S. hunger programs and nutritional survey within our own country.
Which I think the only hope for anything like that is to really start like that.
Sure.
Come out, if you come out with something, it's just going to be thrown out.
Yeah. Well, the president hasn't accepted this yet. And this report does not mention multinationals, and it does not mention lifestyle changes. The final report has small chapters on each of those, but the main focus is foreign policy, which, you know, given that it's a government report, seems in keeping. Warner, did you want to
say? Well, there's certain things on economic aid, you know, outside of military. And, you know, the fact that the percentage has been going down, you know, sort of a tough question, too, because I think one of the reasons the government really, I think, has responded to the feeling within the country that if we're always going to be criticized for giving out money, and then, well, even like this is one of Iran's, you know, complaints that we couldn't get money without maintaining some control, you know. And this has been true of our handouts right down the line. And yet, I guess the question comes up, and you know, where you said that this should be increased, are you willing to, you know, give a handout to a country without, you know, any checks or balances?
The report advocates just that, no strings economic aid.
But how long do you think that would happen?
Well, that's what they recommend.
Yeah, but
because
I mean,
in the past it's been tied to, if you do this, if you allow us to have a military base, we'll give you, that's
what's been the training. Yeah, I think some of those.
But isn't some of the strings to avoid corruption?
Well, that's right. And that's why I say, how long would you be willing to agree to that if then you find out that the money is not going to the people as they promised? See, I think some of the controls come on the basis of, just like every foundation, that if Olin applies for a grant, one of the reasons it's so discouraging is because you have to fill out form after form after form to prove that you're doing with the money what you said you wanted to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I think our government, in a sense, we've told our government, you know, we don't want to hand out money unless, you know, the poor people are actually getting it in the country. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you set up a system to assure us that with our taxes, that money is getting down there. So our government sets up a system which then, in a sense, imposes controls upon the country and does have strings attached to it. But, you know, we've said that we don't want to give money unless there are strings attached. So, you know, I don't know.
Well, there's a difference between a monitoring system, which often goes along with economic aid, irregardless of the country that gives it, and conditions for the aid. And oftentimes we've had military strategic conditions or an interest loan, that's what the aid came as, was an interest loan rather than a free gift. And you know, there are pros and cons to both.
I'm saying that some of the motives I think were wrong, but I don't think all of the controls naturally are you know, are bad.
Well, monitoring systems, like in East Timor, I don't know if you've heard anything or read anything about that just lately.
Is that in Indonesia?
It's under the thumb of Indonesia right now. We were sending aid for East Timor, and it became under suspicion that the people were not receiving any of the food aid that we were sending over there. So in the last month's Bread for the World letter, there was a big push to try and get Congress to push for a monitoring system to find out how that money is actually being spent. And they have moved to do that. And there's been some progress in the situation because the Indonesian government now knows that we are watching and aware that they are misallocating those funds. They, essentially, a lot of people were starving to death. The situation has been described as being worse than Cambodia, not in numbers, but in degree of malnutrition and starvation occurring. And they were supposedly getting aid from this country, but none of it was filtering out to the people. So, yeah, you can't pull out all monitoring, but so the strings question, what are we going to require, is again about.
Just another hypothetical thing, you know, let's say that we are giving aid to a country because we feel strongly that you know, we want to help the starving people in that country. What about, I mean, is it justified in a situation like that that the CIA would go in and support a leader that is sympathetic to our causes to get the money, you know, to the right people? Is that, again, something that we shouldn't be involved in? Or are there situations where we can agree to the CIA going in and supporting a leader? Or is all action by our government to influence leaders in a country wrong?
Well, the Bread for the World Commission or panel accused this report of being paternalistic. And when you read it, there are paragraphs that read, sounds very much like we're going to solve another country's problems. And we don't take very seriously the fact that these are people who have a right to determine what kind of political and economic system they're going to have, how they're going to use money that other countries will give to them. So that whole question of, you know, what are we going to support? Again, you know, that has to be made in every single case, because every nation that you're going to deal with on a foreign aid basis is going to be different. There's no blueprint political system that we can baptize and say, this is the one. If you follow this form down the line, you'll get X number of dollars from us. And this report advocates supporting systems that work. They use all sorts of funny little nebulous phrases because it's a preliminary report, I'm sure. But it kind of has a nose-in-the-air attitude towards what they call them underdeveloped countries in this report. And less developed countries is kind of a term that Bread for the World is advocating as a bit less paternalistic and to start to change the way we even talk about these people. Like we can solve their problem, maybe we're their problem.